Imagine you just donated, let's say $50 to a major relief fund, to help earthquake victims overseas.
Right.
And you picture that money buying a heavy wool blanket, or I mean, maybe a case of sterile bandages.
Exactly. You expect it to do some immediate good.
But what if, thousands of miles away, that exact $50 is being handed to a local warlord?
Wow, yeah.
Like, as a checkpoint tax just to let the aid trucks pass? Or worse, what if the local supplier selling those blankets is, well, what if they're actually a front for an armed militia?
It completely changes the game, doesn't it? I mean, it fundamentally changes how you view the entire life cycle of a donation.
It really does.
Because you suddenly realize that the exact mechanisms designed to save lives, moving money fast, getting goods across borders, those are the exact same mechanisms that bad actors want to exploit to take lives.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a really fascinating, honestly, pretty complex paradox. Nonprofit organizations, NPOs, they do society's most critical work, right? They respond to disasters, they provide medical care, they literally parachute into these vulnerable, destabilized communities. But the traits that make them so effective, the rapid fundraising, moving money across borders quickly, operating in active conflict zones, it makes them perfect targets for terrorist financing.
And to set the stage here, we need to be very, very clear. We are not talking about legitimate charities deliberately setting out to fund terrorism.
No, definitely not.
This deep dive is based on a really detailed report examining a highly complex global financial ecosystem. It's a place where the absolute best of intentions collide with very dangerous realities on the ground.
Right. And our source material today focuses on how one specific jurisdiction, Jersey, is pioneering a way to protect these charities from exploitation, but without, suffocating their legitimate humanitarian work in the process.
Which is a very hard balance to strike.
Exactly. So for you listening, whether you donate to international aid, or maybe you work in finance, or you just want to understand the hidden architecture of global security, this is basically a masterclass in balancing risk and reality. Okay, let's unpack this. How do authorities actually catch the bad guys without stopping the good work?
Well, to understand Jersey's solution, we first have to fully grasp the specific problem. Because when regulators talk about terrorist financing in the nonprofit sector, it is almost never a simple direct wire transfer.
Right, it's not just a charity wiring cash to a known terrorist group.
Never. It is far more insidious than that. It relies on a concept called diversion.
Diversion. And the
Bingo.
report details the many faces of this. And honestly, it really shifts how you think about humanitarian logistics. Like, it's not just a hacker draining a bank account.
I'm not really.
It's that local armed group demanding an access tax to let the aid through. Or it's intermediaries on the ground who inflate the expenses of a community project, and then they just pocket the margin to fund a local militia.
And it goes deeper than cash, too. I mean, humanitarian projects frequently and accidentally, I should add, buy goods from local suppliers who are secretly controlled by armed groups.
Like what kind of goods?
Say, generators, fuel, or building materials. The charity is paying market rate for legitimate goods, but the profit margin is quietly funding terrorism behind the scenes.
Wow.
Or, on the more extreme end, bad actors will literally create sham charities from scratch.
They just invent a charity.
Exactly. They use the veil of a humanitarian purpose to conceal their own fundraising, recruitment, and logistics networks.
The non-cash diversion was a major realization for me when I was reading this. They divert fleets of 4x4 vehicles, satellite radios, heavy machinery.
Oh, absolutely. Physical assets are huge.
And even a charity's reputation gets hijacked. Like, bad actors will clone a trusted charity's social media presence, set up fake appeals, and just siphon off the donations from unsuspecting people.
Which is awful because the real charity never sees a dime.
Right. But their credibility is the tool being weaponized.
Exactly. The value transfer doesn't always have a dollar sign attached to it. A fleet of off-road vehicles in a conflict zone is an incredibly valuable logistical asset to a terrorist organization.
It just sounds like a global supply chain nightmare. Like ordering a laptop, but the parts are stolen, swapped, or taxed by local warlords at every single transit hub on the way to your house.
That's a really good way to put it.
But let's pause here because I want to look at the reality on the ground. If an NPO pays a local warlord a $50 checkpoint fee just to get a truck full of life-saving medical supplies into a starving village, does that really make them a terrorist financier?
Yeah, that's the tough question.
I mean, where is the line? Because if they don't pay it, people literally die.
This raises an important question, and it is one the report addresses head on. The source makes it clear that not every unavoidable payment in a conflict zone automatically establishes terrorist financing.
Okay, that's a relief.
Right. Context and awareness are everything. It depends on the established facts, the applicable law, and crucially, what mitigation measures the charity had in place beforehand.
So what's the deciding factor?
The deciding factor is whether the NPO actually understands where control of its resources changes hands. Do they know the $50 fee is being extorted? Have they documented it? And have they assessed the risk? Or are they just blindly throwing money into a void?
Got it. So it's about transparency and control. It's not necessarily an impossible standard of perfection.
Precisely. Because transferring money to a reputable partner on the ground does not end the charity's responsibility.
Right.
It just changes the form of control required. You can't simply wire the funds to a local NGO and say, well, they're the good guys, so my job is done.
Which naturally leads to the question of how governments usually handle this invisible, messy problem. Like, if diversion is this complex, how do regulators not just panic and shut everything down?
Well, from what the source outlines, the typical regulatory reflex is to panic. Yeah, they usually just throw a giant blanket of heavy compliance over every single charity, no matter how small. But Jersey decided to do something radically different, and they based it on actual data.
Jersey is a fascinating test case for this exact reason. I mean, it is a small jurisdiction, but it holds a disproportionately massive international financial profile.
Huge profile.
Yeah, and they conducted a dedicated national risk assessment of their nonprofit sector, and what the data revealed was striking. There was zero evidence of systemic terrorist financing in their charity sector.
Zero.
In fact, 90% of the relevant organizations were classified as low or standard risk. Their activities were largely domestic, highly transparent, and safe.
So 90% are totally fine. That leaves about 11% that showed characteristics of being vulnerable to these risks.
Wait, 90 and 11? That's 101.
Oh, roughly speaking, based on the report's groupings. The point is, a very small fraction. That 11% comprised the organizations raising or distributing funds internationally, specifically in conflict zones.
Okay, that makes sense.
They were relying on foreign partners or using cash and alternative remittance systems because, you know, conventional banking infrastructure simply didn't exist where they operated.
Right.
So instead of punishing the 90% for the risks of the 11%, Jersey created a brand new, highly targeted legal category in 2023. They called it the prescribed NPO.
The prescribed NPO. And according to the new framework, you only get this label and all the heavy regulatory obligations that come with it if your organization raises or distributes more than 1,000 pounds outside of Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, England, Wales, or Scotland in a 12-month period.
Correct. It is meant to be a strictly risk-based framework. The moment you move money outside that specific domestic bubble, you trigger the new rules.
But 1,000 pounds, that threshold seems incredibly low.
It is low.
Like, if a local community center organizes a bake sale to help with an overseas earthquake disaster, and they manage to raise 1,500 pounds, are they suddenly treated with the same regulatory scrutiny as a multinational bank? That just feels wildly disproportionate for volunteers selling cupcakes.
You are hitting on the exact tension of this entire system. It is a highly debated point. In fact, MoneyVal, which is an international monitoring body that evaluates these financial frameworks, they flagged this exact issue in their 2024 evaluation of Jersey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They warned that a 1,000-pound threshold could create serious proportionality concerns for smaller community-led groups.
Because you don't want the local bake sale organizers having to hire a team of compliance lawyers just to send aid.
Exactly. But to understand why Jersey said it there, you have to look at the core philosophy they're aiming for. A risk-based framework should increase scrutiny where exposure to international diversion is higher.
So it's like a tripwire.
Yes. The threshold is designed as a tripwire to look closer, to ensure absolutely no overseas leakage is missed. It doesn't mean every overseas payment above 1,000 pounds is presumed suspicious. It just means you've stepped into the international arena and the rules of engagement change.
Okay, let's say a charity does cross that tripwire. They are now officially a prescribed NPO. This triggers a massive burden of proof. I want to look at what these organizations actually have to prove now and where the data shows they are struggling the most.
The new obligations under this label are significant. The organizations have to formally identify their controllers, the people who actually call the shots. They have to retain detailed financial records for 5 years. And crucially, they must track significant donors.
The source defines a significant donor as anyone giving over £10,000 in a single year, or anyone making up more than 50% of the charity's total donations for that year.
Which logically makes sense.
Right. If one wealthy individual is funding half your entire operation, authorities want to know if that person is exerting hidden influence or maybe has an ulterior motive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's about uncovering concentrated funding that might dictate where the aid actually goes. But the real meat of this issue surfaced in the 2023 findings from the Jersey Financial Services Commission, the JFSC.
What did they find?
Well, they conducted examinations of these prescribed MPOs, and they found a very distinct pattern. Most charities were actually quite good at the initial paperwork. They had risk appetite statements drafted. They maintained solid donor records. They were strong at the start of the money trail.
But they fell apart at the end of the trail, what the source calls the final mile.
The final mile is the ultimate hurdle. A charity can prove, with perfect banking records, that they wired £50,000 to an overseas partner operating in a conflict zone. But they fundamentally could not prove how that money was ultimately utilized by that partner on the ground.
This is where the practical reality gets so difficult. Like, here's where it gets really interesting. How does a charity sitting in an office in Jersey prove that a crate of water filtration systems was actually delivered to a remote village thousands of miles away?
Exactly.
My first instinct is to say, well, just get a receipt from the local partner. But the source explicitly points out that corrupt partners can easily fabricate invoices.
Oh, easily.
Photographs of aid being delivered can be staged or reused. So what are they supposed to do? Hire a private detective for every sandwich handed out in a war zone?
Right, yeah. It is a monumental challenge. The force's solution is that no single method works in isolation. You cannot just rely on a piece of paper provided by the very person you are trying to verify. It requires triangulating multiple forms of independent evidence.
What does triangulation look like in practice, though?
It means combining standard project reports with independent third-party audits. It means conducting physical, unannounced visits to the program locations if the security situation allows. And crucially, it involves rigorous market analysis.
Market analysis.
Yeah, you compare the receipts provided against the actual market value of the program. Does it make economic sense that a water filtration system costs this much in this specific region at this specific time?
I see.
Trusting a reputable partner on the ground is necessary for humanitarian work. But from a compliance perspective, trust is not verification.
My other instinct here would be to just run the local partners' names and the suppliers' names through a global sanctions database. Like, if they come back clean, you wire the money. Why isn't that enough?
Sanctions screening is a baseline requirement, sure. But the source stresses it is highly insufficient on its own.
Why?
For one, sophisticated bad actors do not use their real names to open bank accounts. They use networks of intermediaries and front companies. Secondly, you run into severe transliteration issues.
Oh, right. Different alphabets.
Exactly. Names translate differently across different alphabets and languages. A common name can trigger 100 false positives, completely paralyzing the aid, while a slight intentional spelling change can slip right through the filter unnoticed. A clean sanctions result just means you didn't catch the most obvious glaring red flag.
And a major vulnerability the report highlighted was training. Independent charities often lack the specialist compliance resources that large corporate trust companies have.
They just don't have the budget.
Right. The volunteers organizing the logistics simply don't know how to spot a fabricated invoice or a transliterated name. And because proving this final mile is so incredibly complex and resource heavy, we arrive at a really dangerous unintended consequence involving the banking sector.
Yes. This is where the commercial banks enter the picture and where the entire system becomes incredibly precarious.
The banks are getting spooked. The source uses the term indiscriminate de-risking. Banks are terrified of massive regulatory fines for accidentally facilitating terrorist financing. So instead of spending the time and money to untangle the messy web of humanitarian aid in a conflict zone, they just close the MPO's bank accounts entirely.
They just wash their hands of it.
Exactly. They refuse to process the payments.
And this creates a massive structural problem. The Financial Action Task Force, FATF, the Global Money Laundering and Terrorist Financing Watchdog, they actually had to revise their Recommendation 8 in 2023 specifically to try and curb this indiscriminate de-risking. Yes, because when a bank panics and closes a charity's account, The charity doesn't just fold up its tents and stop helping people.
Right. The need doesn't disappear, so they just find another way to move the money. It's like closing a newly paved, well-lit highway because it's too difficult to police the speed limit.
That's a great analogy.
You don't actually stop the traffic from moving. You just force all those cars onto unlit off-road dirt paths where you can't monitor them at all. If the banks cut these charities off, they are pushed away from transparent, trackable financial systems and forced to use suitcases of physical cash or mobile money or informal remittance networks like Hawala.
Exactly.
By trying to avoid risk, aren't the banks actually making the terrorist financing problem significantly worse?
What's fascinating here is that that is the ultimate irony, and the answer is yes. De-risking actively reduces global financial transparency. It pushes the money entirely into the shadows, which is exactly where terrorist organizations want it.
Wow.
The source is very firm on this point. Banks need to build models that actually understand humanitarian complexity. For example, a sudden massive payment from a charity to a jurisdiction they've never operated in before might look like classic money laundering to a simple banking algorithm.
Right. The computer just sees a red flag.
But in reality, it might just be a rapid financial response to a sudden devastating earthquake that happened 24 hours ago.
The algorithm doesn't read the morning news about the earthquake. It just flags the anomaly and freezes the account.
Precisely. Banks need to compare the transaction against the charity's specific profile and stated mission. Rather than treating all international humanitarian activity as inherently suspicious, simply because it is complex.
Okay, so we've mapped the battlefield, we know how diversion works, we understand the regulatory tripwires, and we know the banks are complicating the landscape. So, what is the ultimate playbook for a charity trying to navigate this? The report outlines a very specific blueprint.
Yes, the source synthesizes all of these challenges into what it calls a resilient NPO control stack. It is an 8-layer framework designed to catch what the algorithms and the basic receipts miss.
A resilient control stack. It sounds like a cybersecurity firewall, but for physical resources. I want to test this framework. Let's walk through these 8 layers and look at how they actually function in the real world.
Layer 1 is a program-specific risk assessment. This means you don't just assess the overall charity at a macro level. You assess the specific microgeography, the local partners, and the payment methods for that exact project.
Okay.
Sending food to a stable region requires a completely different assessment than sending medical supplies into an active war zone.
That makes sense. What is layer 2?
Documented risk appetite. The board of directors needs to state clearly, in writing, that they have zero tolerance for deliberate diversion.
I have to challenge that a bit. Zero tolerance sounds great on a memo in a boardroom, but how does that actually play out? Does that mean if $1 goes missing, the whole program shuts down?
It's a fair point.
Yeah.
It means they acknowledge that operating in conflict zones carries inherent risk of loss, but they draw a hard legal line at knowingly cooperating with bad actors.
Okay, I see.
It's the difference between a truck being hijacked, which is a risk of the environment, versus willingly paying a warlord a bribe to cross a bridge. Layer 3 reinforces this. Governance.
And governance means what exactly in this context?
It means the board cannot claim ignorance. They must actively approve high-risk programs, and they must receive unfiltered reports when things fail on the ground. They cannot stick their heads in the sand and rely on plausible deniability.
Right.
Moving to layer 4, we have transparent accounting. Literally being able to trace a dollar from the donor's pocket all the way to the program expenditure.
But if I'm operating in a region where the banks have collapsed, or where I'm forced to use an informal network like Hawala just to get cash to my team, how do I maintain transparent accounting?
That is where alternative ledgers come in. If you use Hawala, you must aggressively document the exact amounts transferred, the identities of the brokers used, and reconcile those transfers against the physical cash received and spent by the team on the ground. It requires meticulous, parallel record keeping.
Sounds exhausting, but necessary.
Definitely. Layer 5 builds on this. Proportionate due diligence on donors and partners.
And proportionate means you don't investigate a $10 donor the same way you investigate a $1 million donor.
Correct. You scale the background checks based on the financial exposure. Layer 6, and we spent time on this earlier, is end-use verification.
Right. This is solving the final mile problem, using satellite imagery, third-party audits, and market pricing to prove the goods were actually delivered and used as intended, rather than just trusting the local partner's word.
Exactly. Layer 7 is role-specific training. This is crucial because compliance cannot just live in the legal department. The volunteers packing boxes in a warehouse need to be trained on how to spot diverted physical goods.
While the trustees signing the checks need entirely different training on complex financial structuring.
You've got it. They each need to know their specific piece of the puzzle. And what is the final layer?
Tell me.
Layer 8 is escalation and reporting procedures. Knowing exactly what to do when you discover a problem.
This part of the source was particularly sobering to me. It's not just about calling the police or tipping off a regulator. It's about knowing how to report facts without endangering your staff on the ground. Like, if you formally accuse a local militia of theft without airtight evidence, your aid workers in that region could literally be killed.
It is life and death. Reporting must be based on precise, verifiable facts, the exact transaction path, the specific inventory discrepancy. An unsupported allegation can destroy a legitimate charity's operations, but silence allows the terrorist diversion to continue.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? If you're sitting on the board of a local charity or working in financial crime compliance, what's the ultimate takeaway from Jersey's approach?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the most profound takeaway is that the strongest defense against terrorist financing is neither minimal oversight nor blanket, crushing regulation.
It's somewhere in the middle.
It is targeted, proportionate safeguards. The Jersey data proves that you can isolate the vulnerable 11% and protect the low-risk 90%. But nonprofit organizations become dangerously exposed the moment trust replaces verification. Control cannot end at the first intermediary.
Trust cannot replace verification. That is the perfect distillation of the report. NPOs do essential, beautiful work in some of the most dangerous, unforgiving places on earth. And Jersey's data-driven approach shows a viable path forward. We can target the genuine risks, provided charities learn to rigorously verify that final mile, and provided banks don't indiscriminately cut them off and force that money into the shadows.
It is a delicate, interconnected ecosystem. It requires all parties, the charities, the banks, and the regulators, to stop pointing fingers and actually understand each other's operational realities.
Absolutely. Well, as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with something to mull over. We've spent this entire time talking about the physical realities of tracking money and resources, the hawala brokers, the alternative ledgers, the final mile of physical goods. It is incredibly difficult to verify.
Extremely.
But imagine for a second how the rise of completely untraceable digital currencies or decentralized finance might rewrite these rules entirely. If the charities of the near future don't even need traditional banks to move millions of dollars across borders in an instant, relying entirely on peer-to-peer crypto networks. Who becomes the watchdog then? Does that entire 8-layer framework just become obsolete?
That is a terrifying thought.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you, and we'll catch you next time.